This episode is brought to you by Glorify, the number one Christian daily devotional app. Everything around us changes. God doesn't. That's why I love Glorify's 21-day challenge. It helps me build a simple habit of meeting with God every day. No pressure, just consistency. With Glorify, you can start your morning by reading the Bible passage of the day, diving into Glorify's daily devotional, and wrapping up with an immersive experience called Daily Walk with God. And if you need to take a few minutes to yourself in the middle of a busy day, try one of Glorify's guided meditations or listen to their curated worship playlists for some quiet reflection. To end the day, enjoy Glorify's sleep meditations to help you wind down and put your mind and heart at ease. Whether you're a committed Christian or simply curious about faith, Glorify has something for you. Join over 20 million people who have downloaded the Glorify app and deepened their relationship with God. Listeners to the show can get full access to Glorify for just $29.99 for the entire year. That's Glorify's lowest price ever when you download the Glorify app now at glorify-app.com/redcircle. Feel closer to God this year with Glorify. Get full access all year for just $29.99 at glorify-app.com/redcircle. That's glorify-app.com/redcircle.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Martyrs and Missionaries is a production of Revive Studios.
You're listening to Martyrs and Missionaries. I'm Elise, and in every episode, I'll bring you a new martyr and or missionary, the called and the brave. In this episode, we're talking about the first Protestant missionary to Mexico, Melinda Rankin. Welcome to the first Martyrs and Missionaries episode of 2026. And as I always begin these things now, I have to apologize for taking so long between episodes. I hope that with each new episode, they get closer and closer together, but I have yet to find that synchrony between my teaching schedule and my podcasting schedule. So I have hope, but in the meantime, just bear with me. My apologies. And if you happened to listen to the top five episodes we do at the end of every year, it's a crossover episode I do with Revive Thoughts. If you haven't listened to it, I do recommend it. It's a lot of fun. We obviously talk about our top fives what had the most impact or growth for us and why we personally enjoyed them. But also there's some church history trivia, which is always fun. But at the end of that episode, I said, hey, heads up, we're going to do a French Revolution episode. And so if you're clicked on this and you said, where's the French Revolution episode? It's in progress. So instead of taking even longer to make, new episode, I decided to divert a little bit and go over to Mexico. I don't know if you're like me, but I really didn't know an awful lot about missions in Mexico because, Mexico is very heavily Catholic. And so I didn't really think a lot about, any Protestant missions that would be there. But I happened to think about it one day and said, hey, let's go dig around, see what I can find. And I happened to find this woman named Melinda Rankin. And she has this biography called 20 Years Among the Mexicans. And it's very insightful. Like, this is a period of history that I had really not a lot of knowledge on. And I think you'll find it fascinating. In fact, the French do come into this episode. So if you are really hungering for the French Revolution, maybe this will kind of tide you over or to whet your appetite a little bit. Mexico, as most of us know, is very Catholic today. And it's been Catholic since, the Spanish first came several hundred years ago. It's got a very strong Catholic background. And in 1911, there was this massive revolution that lasted for 12 years, and many non-Catholics were killed. By the 1950s, because of that, 98% of Mexico was Catholic. And today, it's actually 78%, with about 11% identifying as some form of evangelical. But Melinda went in when there was barely a pinprick of Protestant light in the whole country. And this is about 1848. I couldn't find the best place to put this quote. There's a quote that I really loved, and I really couldn't figure out where to squeeze it in. So I thought, let's put it at the very beginning, because I really think that it underpins the heart of her ministry quite well. She said, "It has been a fixed principle with me not to attack the religion, but to present the truth and let that do its work. To this sentiment, which I have found eminently judicious, I am indebted to a man of sainted memory, the late Deacon Charles Stoddard of Boston, Massachusetts, upon whom I called in my early labors from Mexico. After making me a liberal donation for the object I had in hand, he said, 'In your labors among Romanists, make sure to make no decided demonstrations against their religion. Only present the truth to them. If you wish to enlighten a room, you carry a light and set it down in it, and the darkness will disperse of itself.'" So with that in mind, let's go ahead and dive in. I love the way that her book starts, because she said that she was called to Mexico despite being a woman. She didn't want to write this book. She didn't feel like she'd done enough to warrant it, but she hoped that God would bless it nonetheless. And she said, "I bade adieu to my New England home and friends and took up my way toward the west, going as far as Kentucky, which at that period, 1810, was considered quite a remote region." It seems like there was a large swath of Roman Catholics that were basically being sent over to these more remote regions, attempting to convert them to Catholicism. And so Melinda and several others were sent out to counteract that influence. And I can tell you, as someone from Kentucky, that I never met anybody with a Catholic background until I was much, much older and had moved away from the state. And so in a way, I guess it kind of worked, because there really aren't a lot of Catholics, as far as I know, in Kentucky. But once her work was finished there, she moved down to Mississippi to basically do the same thing. And she loved Mississippi, and she got a little bit too comfortable. But she started hearing some different information coming out about Texas, coming out about Mexico, and she had her heart burdened for Mexico, which at this point had no religious liberty, had no religious freedom, and was quite tumultuous. There was the whole annexation of Texas, which occurred by America, and we'll get into that a little bit later. But Mexico had no religious liberty, which meant it was very much against the law to bring a Bible in to teach anything of the Protestant faith. And Melinda felt it on her heart that somebody needed to go out and minister to them. And Melinda wrote, "Were there no hearts to commiserate the helpless condition of those perishing millions of souls under the iron heel of papal power, with its all soul-destroying influences, I could not avoid the impression that an important duty devolved upon evangelical Christendom to try and do something for the moral elevation of this people, who had been so long sitting in the region and shadow of death. Indeed, I felt that the honor of American Christianity most imperatively demanded that some effort should immediately be made. So strongly impressed was I by this that I wrote several articles for publication, hoping to enlist an interest among the churches and missionary boards. But my appeals met with no response, and I resolved, God helping me, to go myself to Mexico and do what I could for the enlightenment of her long-neglected people. Although I could not preach the gospel to them, yet I felt that I could, in ways adapted to my appropriate sphere, do something for bringing its blessings among them." I mentioned earlier how Texas had been annexed, or basically made a part of the U.S. in about 1845. But Texas itself is very dangerous. But it is the closest you can get to Mexico, obviously. And so this is where she needed to go. Texas is kind of overrun by criminals and bandits. And so going as a single woman is an incredibly bold and daring adventure that could meet with some pretty serious mishaps. And so she knows this. But still, she carries on. She goes with no job, no prospects. She's on a ship headed for Texas, and she runs into a gentleman and his niece. This gentleman turns out to be the head of a school, which is looking for teachers, specifically for female teachers. And so this is kind of her in into Texas. She's not really near the border of Mexico. She's more like in the middle, but she loves her job. And then when she's not been there very long, she gets this horrible long illness, which seems to be yellow fever. Later low for almost a year, thought she was going to die, but obviously she did not. And a couple years later, she writes a pamphlet called Texas 1850, which is telling people what's going on in Texas and how they can help and get on board. And it just kind of falls on deaf ears. But she ends up working for the next couple of years on building up these schools. And then she feels as though she really needs to get closer to Mexico. And this was kind of pushed onto her mindset, because 2 years before, a Presbyterian missionary had come to the church she attended and said that the Mexicans he met were interested in learning about the Bible. And so she was like set aflame a little bit and wanted to go kind of capitalize on this. So she moves to Brownsville, which is right there at the border. So you have the Rio Grande, and then you have Brownsville, and then across, I believe, is Matamoros, I think, is kind of in that area. So you're very much, you can basically almost look over into Mexico. As she's heading there, she hears about a group of Indians who are attacking settlers, and she thinks, should I turn back? This seems really dangerous. And then she wrote, "But could I turn back because of the difficulties ahead? I thought of the trials of Pilgrim from Pilgrim's Progress, who met lions in the way, and also of the advice given him, to keep in the middle of the road, and the lions could not harm him. Duty to God was my watchword, and on his powerful arm I trusted for protection. I resolved to go forward." So she took a stagecoach headed for Brownsville, and the driver asked her where she wanted to be dropped off. And she said, "Well, just send me to the best hotel in town." Turns out there isn't a best hotel in town. There's no hotel in town. But there is a German lady who occasionally accepts boarders. And so he drops her off there. She spends one night, and the next morning she heads over to spend a couple of days with an American family, but they can't give her permanent board either. And then she asks around and is eventually forced to rent out two rooms, one for her personal living and the other for the school she wished to start. The night before her school was to open, she had no bed and no way of cooking for herself. And about an hour before she went to bed, a Mexican lady stopped by to give her a cot. An American lady brought her a pillow. And a German lady said that she would cook all of her meals and bring them to her, which was, I'm sure, a great relief for her. And the next day, she opens up her school to five students. More were promised. And she felt that the school would be the most use to people in that moment, because she can't go over to Mexico. She can't openly preach the gospel there. And so if she had started a school in Mexico, she would have been shut down and put in prison. But because many Mexicans had actually chosen to stay in Texas, even though it was in U.S. control, she had an easy access to many people who were living there. And some of her students could read Spanish, and some of them learned spoken English. And her parents really didn't have any qualms about sending them to read from the Bible, because their biggest thing was that they wanted them to learn English and become more Americanized. She said, "Although the work might look small to the eye of human reason, yet faith bade me hope that it might prove a beginning, and I was satisfied to work on even in this small way. The parables of our Savior afforded me much encouragement, especially those in which he compares the kingdom of heaven to a grain of mustard seed, which, when sown, is the least of all seeds, yet from it sprang a tree sufficiently large enough for the fowls of heaven to lodge in its branches." Now, spiritually, she's feeling very secure, but physically, she feels very exposed, because you've got these Indians that are roaming around the outskirts of town, and they're liable to raid at any moment. And then you've got these bandits who she had been repeatedly warned would murder her just for her dress. And there were just many anxious weeks that she felt like she couldn't sleep. She had to keep, watch. And she eventually says, "If I get broken into, if my house gets broken into, then I'm going to head out. I'm out of here." But nothing happens. And eventually, even though she's still anxious, she decided that she needed to trust God with her life and trust that he would actually keep her safe. And so her school prospered, and there was a decisive change in many of the children. They had previously had a problem with stealing. They were no longer stealing. And the children began telling their parents about what they were learning from the Bible. And so these parents saw these changes for themselves and wanted to talk to Melinda. And I think this is fascinating, because it's a way that God still works today. I've heard a few stories very recently about parents whose kids go to a Christian school or have some influence of Christians. And so they want to understand what their kids are learning. And so through this, they begin to learn about the gospel for themselves and come to faith. Or, it's an amazing thing that God uses even still. So in Melinda's case, one of the mothers of her girls came to Melinda's house and brought a saint. And she said she'd prayed to this saint for years and had not done a thing for her, and she wanted to trade it for a Bible. Melinda said, "Great, I'll give you two, actually." And this lady said, great, I have a friend who's over in Matamoros who wants one. And this woman and her daughter would actually go on to be her most efficient helpers in getting Bibles into Mexico. And she was actually able in this way to get Bibles or portions of Bibles to many of the parents. But as she writes, there were millions upon the other side of the Rio Grande who, by the most stringent laws of the government, were shut up in impenetrable darkness. When I cast my eye over into that priest-bound country, my heart yearned for its emancipation from the dreadful tyranny of papal laws. But upon my distressing thoughts, a light suddenly arose by ascertaining that Bibles were being carried over into that dark land by the Mexicans on the American side of the river. Although I knew the transfer of Bibles into Mexico to be a direct violation of the laws of the country, yet I felt no conscientious scruples in lending them my aid, for I felt God's word was to be above all human law, and no earthly power had the right to withhold it from any of God's accountable creatures. Dozens of Bibles were carried over the river and distributed among the people who gladly received them. I became convinced that good might be done even by this slight skirmishing upon the outskirts of the enemy's camp. The missiles that were being sent there were of a character to do powerful execution, and I doubted not that it would ultimately be seen by them essential damage had been received in this kingdom of darkness where Satan had so long reigned with undisputed sway. In the midst of this, there was a bunch of Catholic priests and nuns who came from France to build a church and to teach the people. And she began to despair and thought, how can I keep up with this? How can I compare to an official missionary party? And she felt that she needed some kind of competitive building. And it wasn't because the gospel was insufficient or because she felt that she needed this building to help people to worship, but that people are fickle. And so if they see this beautiful Catholic church across the way and she doesn't have anything that can even possibly remotely be compared to this, that people would be drawn away because they're superficial. And so she needed to go to the States and ask for money to build this building. She said, after all, if France could send $4 million after all their woes, then why not Protestant Christians in America? And they do have a lot of woes because you have the French Revolution, you have Napoleon, you've got revolutions of both government and then back to royalty and all this stuff. And still, they managed to make it a priority. So she said, Christians surely should be able to do this. I just need a few hundred for the Rio Grande. So she takes this tiny boat going across the Gulf during what I can only assume must be hurricane season. And the storms are so bad that the ship is feared lost at sea. It takes them 2 weeks over when they were projected to arrive to come into harbor, and they're feared all dead. There's actually reports coming out of a newspaper called the Daily Picayune, which is a fantastic name for a newspaper. And so you can imagine the relief when they pull into harbor and everybody's fine. But this is one of many arduous and dangerous trips she will take back and forth. So while she's there, she meets with Protestant pastors, and they are not interested at all in building a church on the frontier where Catholicism held so much sway. They said it was absurd and a fantasy to entertain such a hubristic hope. And others were concerned whether she had the fortitude to withstand the difficulties of battling with the foreign papery, as they called it. A rather ironic question, because she's actually there doing the work and they are not. And at one of these meetings, there's a Christian gentleman who most kindly admonished her that the undertaking was entirely incompatible with the character of a lady and advised her not to expose herself in collecting funds in the manner in which she was pursuing. He said, "You will receive rebuffs and insults which will kill all the finer instincts of the soul." So she leaves this meeting and she is subdued and she vows she will never again ask for money. But there was this house nearby that had expressed interest in talking to her. And so she goes in. There's actually a group of men there who are chatting, and so she joins their meeting, and she apologizes. She said, "I'm so sorry. I'm a woman. I really shouldn't be doing this." And there's a man that kind of pulls her aside and says, "By no means is it contrary to the most refined delicacy of the female sex to be engaged in works of philanthropy for the elevation of a people in need." She didn't receive an awful lot of money, but she received spiritual encouragement and letters of recommendation to influential men who would be able to help more. She goes to the Presbyterian Board of Education in Louisville, Kentucky, gets the same old arguments, and one of these men, Dr. Chester, was determined that her endeavors would be an abject failure. And she grew frustrated. She stood up and she said, "Gentlemen, I leave the responsibility of the proper education of the youth of that portion of country upon your hands. I have done what I can, and henceforth my skirts are cleared of the criminal negligence of leaving the beloved youth of the Rio Grande Valley to the baleful influence of foreign popery." Dr. Chester immediately rose to his feet and with much emphasis said, "I am not going to take the Rio Grande upon my shoulders. You are the one to bear that burden. We have fully tested your proper understanding of the difficult enterprise and your ability in carrying it forward. We are now ready to inquire of your wants." I replied, "I must have money." "How much?" he said. I felt quite subdued and modestly replied, $200 or $300. He replied, "You must not leave Philadelphia with less than $500. If the Board of Education do not see it proper to give you $200, I will pay it out of my own pocket, and the remaining $300 I will put you in the way of obtaining from the Presbyterian churches of the city." From there, she goes on to Boston and collected another $500. She said, "Oh, how my heart exulted in the prospect of the Bible having its place and exerting its due influence upon the hearts and minds of the rising generation in that land." But one of the things she was really fighting against was people's racism towards Mexicans and towards Mexico in general. She said the sentiment was expressed by many that the Mexicans were a people just fit to be exterminated from the earth. Even ministers of the gospel said to me, "We had better send bullets and gunpowder to Mexico than Bibles." Of such, I generally ask the question, what class of persons did our Savior come from heaven to save, the righteous or the wicked? Just such a class of sinners as the Mexicans. Sometimes I would receive donations in this way, and they would say, "We do not care for the Mexicans, but seeing you so devoted to their cause, we'll give you something for your sake." This was what she found most often in the cities. But when she went to the countryside, people were actually much more generous, and so she often found herself walking about 8 to 10 miles between these plantations. But she was so warmly welcomed that she really didn't notice the fatigue. It didn't really drain on her at all. Now, in 1854, she happens to find herself in Natchez, Mississippi. She's raising funds. There's a very generous woman. She wasn't at home, but her husband was. And she wrote, "He very pleasantly replied that perhaps he would do as well, and if I pleased, I might deliver my message to him. Thus encouraged, I gave a very elaborate delineation of the great need of evangelical laborers in that papal land, especially as it was becoming overrun by foreign Roman Catholicism. I was unusually eloquent upon the subject, as my listener manifested such a deep interest. When I concluded, he arose, went to his desk, took out $20, and handed me, saying, 'I presume you do not know that I am Roman Catholic.' And there were a few feathers dropped out of my cap at that moment, and the most profound mortification took possession of me. But his smiling face reassured me, and I very meekly said that I did not know he was Catholic. 'I am so by name only. My parents and all my ancestors were Roman Catholic, but I have no preferences for that religion. My wife is Episcopalian, and I attend her church.' He continued, 'I am convinced you will do good to those people and have very cheerfully contributed my aid.' We parted the best of friends, and I told him that in future I would take a better lookout lest I find more dangerous soundings than what I had found with him." One of these ladies with whom she found more dangerous soundings came out of left field because there was a very wealthy woman. She was known to be very generous, very sweet. People loved her. She's also in Natchez. When Melinda goes to meet her, she's not at all generous. She is a very hateful woman. She accused Melinda of being an imposter. Melinda gives her her letters of recommendation, and this lady said, "I don't care about your letters. I think maybe you forged them." And so Melinda is no longer concerned with trying to, you know, raise money for the mission. She's like, "I just don't want you to think I'm an imposter." And this woman told her servant to kick her out, and so she would never see her again. And Melinda leaves the house. She's humiliated, and tears are streaming down her face, but she composed herself for the next house. And the lady in this next house was really kind and gave her a generous donation. And at the end of the visit, she said, "Have you visited my sister? She's a very benevolent woman." But Melinda didn't have the heart to tell her that this woman had been a monster to her. And in this case, we get kind of a what happened afterwards story with this lady. So as Melinda is traveling through the area, she reads a newspaper and turns out there is a railroad accident. And this woman's body was so broken that she had to live in a shack from which she could not be moved. Melinda wrote, "My heart was moved at the recital of her distress. I could only put up the prayer that God would comfort her and forgive her for so misjudging me. But I soon passed on from there and never heard of her again." About 14 months later, she is back in Texas, and she experiences a lot more racism towards Mexicans, and a lot of it comes from her fellow Protestants. They were just very down on her ministry. And she eventually was just kind of like, "I'd rather talk to Catholic priests than meet with Protestants," which is just really sad, right? But in this time, the seminary is built and all of her former students have returned, as well as several that came from the convent. So while she was gone, it seems like they kind of went over to the convent, but she gets them all back. because, and sadly, not because they were like, oh, we really need to hear more of the gospel. It was English. They really wanted the English, and the French obviously could not provide that. But she's like, hey, I've got all these students. Let's make it work. But as the school continued to grow, she needed more help with the work. She couldn't both distribute Bibles and keep teaching anymore. But no one could be found that could speak Spanish, and so nobody was sent. This is people from her org. She has affiliation with the board of the American and Foreign Christian Union. And then she says, hey, I can go out and I can distribute these Bibles and I can read to people and I can go into homes, but I need you to help me pay somebody basically to teach. And so they agreed. And so she spent her time traveling from home to home, giving out Bibles to everybody who could read, and only a few turned her away. But her friends, these wonderful friends she had, tried to convince her that they were giving them to the priests to be burned. I can only think at this point, does she have Job's friends? Because that really would make a lot of sense. But she went to the house of one of these students who had been absent for a long time. And she said, hey, you know, where's your daughter? And she said, well, my daughter died of yellow fever. And she loved her Bible so much that we actually buried her with her Bible. And then she has kind of the same story of a father with his son. He loved his Bible so much that his Bible was buried with him. And then she was getting even more requests from Mexico for Bibles, requests that were actually sent with the money to pay for them. And she got to thinking, like, is it some sort of trick? But no, it wasn't. They just wanted Bibles because the priest said that they couldn't have them, and they wanted to see what was in it. And then alongside this, there was a German Protestant portrait painter, which is kind of a tongue twister to say, but he was also a Bible distributor. So he would use his portrait painting to go into Mexico and then be able to kind of distribute Bibles on the side. And one day he is killed, and nobody really knows if it was because of the Bibles or because he was robbed. Melinda said, nothing more was ever heard of him by his friends. He was eminently a man of God, and we felt assured that like the martyr Stephen, he had fallen asleep in Jesus, although a violent death was permitted to be his. But he's one of these people who helps bring in and kind of settle like the ground, kind of prepare the ground for when they are eventually able to go into Mexico. But before all this happens, she had written a pamphlet entitled, and I think she had sent it to the States, but it was entitled, I Hate Romanism. Now, this paper had been gotten a hold of by the convent in Brownsville, and they spread it around and they showed it to the parents of Melinda's pupils and said she hated Catholics. Why do you send your student to her school? And the parents were like, she loves our students. She visits them when they're sick and she cares for them when they're at school. She wrote to her org about what was going on, and then somebody there got really fired up and decided to publish a letter that she had sent, and he titled it, An Attempt Made by the Romanists to Destroy the Protestant Seminary Building at Brownsville. Not at all helpful, because once again, the convent gets their hands on it and the whole thing just blows up. The convent accuses her of lying, publishes the letter locally, and then spreads it around. Even friends who had told her they were worried about her building refused to speak up in her defense. And these Catholic priests went from house to house talking to each of her students, and more than half of them, some even among her close friends, pulled their children out of the school. And she's in a very dark place. She said, I cast myself upon the Lord. I tried to shelter myself under the shadow of the Almighty. And she heard one day that there was a Catholic woman, an American, who said that the judgment of God must come upon Miss Rankin. And I replied immediately, I will also submit the matter to the judgment of God. And if I am guilty of wrong as you represent, let divine judgment fall upon my head. But if your party are guilty, let the deserved judgment be passed upon it. One of the biggest instigators of this was the Father Superior. I didn't realize that there was a Father Superior. I only knew about Mother Superior because of The Sound of Music, but apparently there are also fathers. Now, he is the biggest rival and stirrer up of controversy, but he has to leave on a trip to New Orleans. But in his absence, he leaves instructions to keep up the pressure. And once again, it is hurricane season in the Gulf. All but one man was killed, and that one man was not Father Superior. The community was so busy mourning the loss of the Father Superior that they forgot about her entirely. And then within about 2 months, all of her students were back.
This episode is brought to you by Glorify, the number one Christian daily devotional app. Everything around us changes. God doesn't. That's why I love Glorify's 21-Day Challenge. It helps me build a simple habit of meeting with God every day. No pressure, just consistency. With Glorify, you can start your morning by reading the Bible passage of the day, diving into Glorify's daily devotional, and wrapping up with an immersive experience called Daily Walk with God. And if you need to take a few minutes to yourself in the middle of a busy day, try one of Glorify's guided meditations or listen to their curated worship playlists for some quiet reflection. To end the day, enjoy Glorify's sleep meditations to help you wind down and put your mind and heart at ease. Whether you're a committed Christian or simply curious about faith, Glorify has something for you. Join over 20 million people who have downloaded the Glorify app and deepened their relationship with God. Listeners to the show can get full access to Glorify for just $29.99 for the entire year. That's Glorify's lowest price ever when you download the Glorify app now at glorify-app.com/redcircle. Feel closer to God this year with Glorify. Get full access all year for just $29.99 at glorify-app.com/redcircle. That's glorify-app.com/redcircle.
And now the year is 1857. This is a big year for Mexico, and it's kind of a big year or a rough year for Melinda because it's the fight for religious freedom for Mexico. Mexico decided they had had enough of the current ruling party. They wanted to be more free. And so that was an ongoing battle that took a couple of years to resolve. And then in that time, she lost her assistant teacher of 3 years to yellow fever. The year after that, she comes down with yellow fever herself. She's near death, and she's this really sweet story about the grandmother of one of her students who had come to care for her, and this lady was a nurse. She wrote, "After some days of unremitting care, she came to me one morning saying that she had received a call to go and nurse three strangers who had been stricken with the prevailing fever, with the offer of $15 a day, as the case was a most urgent one. I said, 'You will go, will you not?' and urged her to do so, as I knew their need of money. She replied most emphatically, 'I shall not leave you until I know you are past all danger to go and take care of others, although they will pay me so much.' But she added, 'I have too much gratitude in my heart for what you have done for me and mine to take any pay for what I have done for you. I will not leave you,' and nor did she, until she was perfectly satisfied that I needed her services no longer." When she has sufficiently recovered and thinks she's going to be able to get back to life as normal, there is an outlaw, a rather infamous outlaw. His name is Cortinas, and he had it out for Americans he felt had wronged him. One day, he's a totally normal guy. Something flipped the switch. Melinda isn't sure what it is, but he has this list. And as he comes into Brownsville, he begins calling these men out, or women, I'm not sure, but calls them out by name and then has them killed, many of them in front of their families. He has about 60-odd men with him who take over the city and kept any word from going out about what they were doing. But there is one brave courier who made it out and then sent word to the governor, who immediately sent his men and chased Cortinas off. And then he comes back reinforced, and Melinda felt she had to flee, she had to get away and stay with a Mexican lady who had offered her shelter before. Now, this lady she was staying with had actually given many of her friends these Bibles and these Bible books. And so she was excited to see kind of how much impact they had had. And so she was very happy to find that actually there was a massive appreciation for the word. And this woman said that if they had known the Bible before, we would have believed it. And then she also found a whole school of some 30 boys supplied with a New Testament, which they read daily. And the teacher was an elderly Mexican man who had a Bible, which he had procured many years before from a British vessel lying in a Mexican port. Melinda said she visited his school, and he expressed great gratitude to me for furnishing him so as to enable him to put a copy of the Blessed Book into the hands of all of his pupils. He told me he had learned from the Bible to cast away his idols and to trust in Christ for salvation. My friend told me that this man, in speaking of me, was accustomed to call me sister, and I was pleased to reciprocate the appellation by recognizing him as a brother in Christ. Finally, by the end of 1859, Christmas Day, good news finally comes to Mexico. There's a man named Juarez, and the Liberal Party had entered the capital. They had been elected. There was religious freedom now allowed in all of Mexico. Melinda wrote, "Was this not a bright era in Mexican history? The gates of brass were broken in pieces. The bars of iron were cut asunder. and 8 millions of souls threw off the shackles of popery and emerged into the liberty wherewith God makes his people free. The popular demonstrations, the ringing of bells, and the firing of cannon by the people generally evinced their great joy for the precious boon of religious liberty. As the noise from Matamoros broke upon my ear, I thought I'd never heard more delightful sounds, and my heart bounded in joyful anticipation that God's word could now have free course, run, and be glorified. Men immediately came over from Matamoros for Bibles and tracts, saying, "We can now distribute Protestant books without any hindrance. We will pay you for all you can let us have." And so I supplied them to the extent of my ability and wrote on to the Bible and Tract Society for greater supply. When these Protestant preachers and Bible distributors came into Mexico, many of them found that the Bible and knowledge of Protestantism had already actually preceded them. The groundwork had already been laid, and many of the Mexicans they encountered either professed faith or wanted to learn more. But in the midst of this, the Civil War gets underway, the American Civil War. The ports are blocked, and there's trouble for a while getting these Bibles and materials into the country. The ports do eventually open up, but then we have the French. This is where they come in. I didn't know this, maybe you did, but from 1862 to 1867, France tries to take over Mexico while America is distracted with the Civil War. In 1862, they take over Mexico City and install a puppet government led by Maximilian of the Austrian Habsburgs, who was then declared the Emperor of Mexico. A very, very strange story. This is Napoleon III who decides to do this whole thing. And actually, it turns out Maximilian doesn't really want to do this, but his wife, Carlotta, very devoutly Catholic, says, "Hey, this is an opportunity. We need to do this and lead these people back into the faith. And so by doing this, you are a great man of God, and this is how God will use you." Well, you can't disagree with that, right? So he goes and does this thing. He becomes emperor of Mexico. But it turns out the people don't really want to be ruled, and they don't want to be shoved around with no religious liberty. And so eventually he makes kind of a compromise with them to give them religious liberty, which makes the Pope especially really, really upset. Well, once the Civil War ends and America kind of turns her eye back to what is happening in Mexico, Napoleon III decides, gonna leave you here. And he just takes his troops, moves out, leaves Maximilian completely alone. And his wife, Carlotta, I guess she's back in Europe at this point. So she tries to plead with Napoleon III to send his troops back. He's like, nah. And then she goes over to the Pope, and the Pope's still mad at him because, you know, of the whole religious liberty thing. And by the time she leaves the Vatican, she's actually declared she's insane. She lost her mind. Don't know what happens to her after that. But later on, I think Maximilian tries to kind of get his control back by then taking out the religious liberty. The people aren't having it. Eventually, he is executed. Now, Melinda tells this story kind of in snippets. So she'll tell like one aspect of the story and then kind of bounce back to what else was going on in this timeline. So for her personally, in 1862, she was commanded to give up her school to the Southern Presbyterians. The Southern Presbyterians are Woodrow Wilson's people, and if you know anything about them, they're not great people, okay? They're very much pro-slavery, among other things. And so she is forced out and takes her stuff and moves to Matamoros. She's in Mexico proper now, but life kind of becomes too tenuous there due to the Confederacy ties. So they're allowing the Confederacy to use these ports. Melinda is obviously from the North. She's not a Confederate, and so she's seen as a Yankee, a Unionist, and she is not welcome in Matamoros. So she has to leave. Now she ends up going into this town called Baghdad, which is not in the Middle East, but I guess there's a little town in Mexico called Baghdad. And this town was under Confederate control. And because of this, they wouldn't allow her to rent any rooms because she's a Yankee. But there is a kindly man, a Canadian, who takes pity on her. And then she's actually trying to get over to New Orleans with her aunt and I think a couple of nieces or nephews. And this man puts them up in his tiny boat. And the town goes even further and says, "We're not even going to feed you." So this man had to kind of sneak out and, you know, get them food and all of that. And then after a few days of this, there's better accommodations they find with a northerner who was making money off the Confederates. He didn't want to jeopardize his lucrative hustles, so he lets them stay in the hold of the boat. And eventually, they're like this for, I don't remember how many days, it was like almost 2 weeks or something like that. But eventually, they are able to make this trip to New Orleans with about 100 other refugees from Texas. And while she's there, she's not idle, as these people never are. They're always doing something, right? So she decides to see how the Union soldiers are being cared for in the hospitals and finds out it's rather atrocious. And so she decides to go and help these Union soldiers. She, you know, ministers to them herself and then also raises money for their care. And then by like the next year, she is helping to establish the first freedmen's schools for Black Americans. And she met a man there who had been a pastor for about 40 of his 60 years on earth, but he didn't know one letter of the alphabet. And he told her how he came to the Lord. He said, "When I thought myself sinking down into eternal woe due to my sins, there appeared one before my eyes who showed me his pierced hands and sighed and said, 'All this I suffered that you might be saved from the punishment of your sins. Oh, I fell down at the feet of this loving Savior, and he raised me up, saying, thy sins are forgiven thee.' I went to tell others of this loving Jesus, and I cannot tell you of the great numbers who have been brought to feel themselves sinners and made to rejoice in the same forgiving love. I still tell the wonderful story, and though it was 40 years ago I first learned of my Savior's love, it is still new." That's a beautiful story. I really love that one. By 1864, she returns to Brownsville, and the seminary building and about every other building in town has been heavily damaged, if not just outright destroyed. And so she has to fix and repair all the cracked bricks and then replace all the windows and all of this. But while she's there, there's kind of a revival that has taken place or had taken, I'm not sure. But at some point, there had been a revival in this town. And she talks to this young Irishman who is grateful for the war because it was there that he'd met Christ. But soon the Confederates would retake the town, so they all had to evacuate once again. And so she's back in New Orleans. She's teaching at the freedmen's schools. And then finally the war ends and she returns. But now they need a more permanent mission presence in northern Mexico in a place called Monterrey. This is a Catholic stronghold, and others wondered if they ought not to set up somewhere different where they wouldn't necessarily be in direct competition. But Melinda said that they might as well attack the strongholds and grapple with the Prince of Darkness on his throne by establishing the truth in the very heart of his domain. But they needed buildings. And so as she would try to rent out these buildings, the church would eventually find out she was teaching the Bible and then would basically make it impossible for her to stay, would find some way of kicking her out. And then eventually she finds one building that she could stay in. But she needs to expand it, and they needed a few different buildings. And so she needs money. So she goes off to the States again. But as is no surprise to you now, this isn't an easy voyage. In fact, it's probably one of her most difficult voyages because Cortines is back. He's that bandit guy who took over Brownsville a couple years back. He is making it really, really difficult to get things in and out of Mexico. He's harassing and haranguing all these different convoys. But there was one convoy that made it through. This was the French convoy. So they were very heavily armed. They had just successfully returned from America. And so people felt that they would be safe if they traveled back. And so they did something honestly kind of foolish. They thought, okay, they've already made this trip. It's fine. So they began to load them down with supplies. Well, supplies and money, which paints an even bigger target on their back. Now, Melinda wouldn't have taken this convoy I think she was just, I would imagine alarm bells are going off, right? But also, she was deeply convicted that the French should not be in Mexico, and so she didn't want to take any kind of help from them whatsoever. And so she finds a passage with an American stagecoach who says, "Hey, I'll help you out, don't worry." Now, they had to be very careful in how they were going to America because they didn't want to be too close to the convoy. Well, eventually they decide, let's just go off on a different path. So they kind of veer off and they land right in the middle of Cortines's camp. And he is not there, so they kind of hold them kind of hostage for a little while until Cortines gets back and he can tell them what to do with them. Well, Melinda's looking around. They got a lot of sick people in the camp. And she said, maybe I can create some goodwill if I help these guys. So she takes out some medicines and starts giving it out to the guys. Then she helps them with some food. She kind of makes meals for them. So when Cortines comes back, he is hungry. He gets some food. He looks around, kind of sees what she's been doing, but he's preoccupied because they're small potatoes. Nobody really cares about them because you've got this French convoy just laden. Like, imagine it just glowing, you know, just like this, you know. And so he doesn't care about them. He lets them go. Now, the French convoy is not lucky this time. They end up getting completely just broken apart, everything stolen. I guess Cortines specifically had a problem with Confederates, so he would let Union soldiers go, but not Confederate soldiers, and they died. And then he turns around, has the convoy turn around and sent back to Mexico, empty, bereft of supplies and bereft of certain men. And yeah, Melinda's very glad she didn't end up taking that convoy. Now she's back in New York. It's 1865, and she needs to raise $10,000 to $15,000 for these buildings. Her board thinks that's too much, and so says, hey, it's great and all, but go ahead and raise it independently. She tells them this is a fair price, but goes ahead and raises it. She gets the money for her buildings, gets them remodeled. There are many converts that come because they're able to kind of house more people, host more people, teach more people, etc. And some of these men become quite well-versed in the scripture and evangelizing. And so she wants to take four of her best men and then send them out full-time to evangelize. But she needed money to help keep their families fed. They weren't getting paid for the gospel, but they were farmers, and so their families needed money while they were gone. And they decided about $30 a month per man would be fair. And so she has to go back to New York to get money from the board, permission from the board. Well, the board says they don't have any money for that. It's all been promised to other fields, but it's a good idea, and she should totally independently raise these funds. You gotta ask, what is the point of this org? Okay, they're not helpful, like, at all, like, ever. But she carries on. She decides not to go to churches proper, as many of them had already given to the missions org, and so they were kind of, like, you know, off the table. So she goes to the ladies' groups. And these ladies wanted to give in abundance. They loved what she was doing. They felt the heart of her mission. And so she had so much money raised from these ladies that she was actually able to outfit several different teams of two and send them out for a month at a time. Now, after a year, they had traveled from house to house, from ranch to ranch, 100 miles in every direction around Monterey. And Melinda said that there were many brought into the kingdom by these faithful men. The mission continued to grow, and they actually branched into a region some 400 miles away, expecting that nothing would be there. Well, it turns out that there had been harvests that had been prepared by an American man who had labored there for a number of years. And so soon they had a church of 170 members, which was built actually by Mexicans themselves, not by foreign workers, which is even more incredible. And on top of that, this is in the heart kind of a Catholic stronghold, but there are just so many reports that are coming out of Monterey. One of these reports, Melinda wrote, "All ages and conditions alike are influenced by the transforming power of the gospel. A man who had been a terror to the country around by his savage conduct had been so changed that he has the spirit of a lamb. His wife, who had often been obliged to hide herself to escape his beatings, providentially met with a poor girl who had become a convert to the truth, to whom she related the brutal treatment she frequently received from her husband. This girl told her of the religion which the Bible taught, in which husbands were commanded to love their wives and not be bitter against them. The unfortunate woman was forcibly struck by the blessedness of such a religion and begged the girl to get the book which contained it, that she might be able to help her husband to read it. And the girl didn't have a Bible herself, but kind of put her in contact with some people who did. There was a lady who was a Christian who was then urged to come and read the Bible to her husband. And Melinda said that the man listened with attention to this first knowledge that he'd ever received from God's word. He became deeply interested, and after abandoning one sin after another, he became an entirely changed man in heart and conduct. And as soon as his mind began to be enlightened, he tore down his images, with which his house abounded, and he threw them away. His own language to one of our evangelists soon after this great change was, 'We have been taught to worship devils instead of God. The Church of Rome is as different from the Church of Christ as hell is from heaven. How beautiful is the religion of Christ!' Now his wife also rejoices in the truth, and it has been 3 months since his conversion, and he seems to be growing more and more sensible of the great sinfulness of his past life and the great obligation he is under to God for snatching him as a brand from the burning. And furthermore, there were two men who threatened to shoot the evangelists if they came there with their Bibles, and these men are now sitting at the feet of Jesus in their right minds. That Mexico is ripe for the gospel, and that God is wonderfully raising up these native agencies to cultivate this promising field is equally evident. By around 1869, there are 6 churches and 8 schools in this region, and an evangelist about 100 miles away, where no known Christians or missionaries had existed, found these 12 believers, and these men had come across a tract in the Bible. And the tract showed the errors of Catholicism, and they tested it against the Bible, and not being under the oversight of a priest, decided to break away from the Catholic faith. A little church was soon set up there, and this church proved to be, as Melinda put it, one of their staunchest churches. And then she relates this story about that they had this Virgin Mary statue at kind of the beginning of town, kind of as you walked in. And one day, right before a giant saint's day, this statue had been knocked over and was destroyed. And the local police were kind of like, they were supposed to protect the Protestants because the Protestants had basically come under persecution. There were death threats. There was vandalism. It got so bad that Melinda was thinking she would have to flee the country. Friends were watching her house. There was possible gunpowder shoved into the drains under the buildings. The local police were completely worthless. They actually would keep closing their eyes, like physically closing their eyes, so they wouldn't see what was going on, which is kind of crazy to think about. So she goes to the mayor and he promises protection, but you know, it's kind of worthless, right? So then she goes to and writes a district official. There's a slow response because there is a revolution, which we'll talk about in just a second. But when he finally writes back several weeks later, he promises support. Well, then she decides to write to the governor and just basically write everybody, let them know what's going on. The governor finally deals with it. What it seems like happened is that the priests destroyed this statue themselves. So a few weeks before, maybe a few months before, they had been visited by some of their higher-ups. And these higher-ups were mad at the priests because they had allowed Protestantism to gain too strong of a foothold in the region. And they said, hey, if you don't get it under control, put a stop to it, we will fire you when we come back around. And so I guess their idea of dealing with it was trying to harass them into leaving. It doesn't work. Don't know what happens to these guys later, but it doesn't work. Now, a couple of years later, it's 1871. Mexico is in the throes of a massive revolution. And this we've had enough of these stories, right? You kind of know that where growth is, where the gospel is spreading, there's generally some kind of, especially political upheaval or other things that happens to kind of try to slow that down. So many people were convinced of the current president, Juarez, that he was not a great guy. And so he'd been in power for like 14 years or something like that. And they needed a new president to oppose him. And so, revolution. And there were soldiers that came into her town. These are revolutionaries. They are bad guys. They were killing people in the streets. They took her friend, pressed him into service or something, or killed him. I think just pressed into service, but it's kind of unclear. They try to break into her house, and she has these two young boys with her that she kind of hid away in case harm came to them. She's trying to figure out how to calm them down because they were really upset. She doesn't really have bars on her doors, and so they could definitely break in if they really, really worked at it. So she said, let me go ahead and try to maybe feed them. Maybe they'll feel better if I give them food. And so she kind of gives them food through the bars of her window. Well, they're thirsty. So she goes and gets them some water. Well, she tries to pass a glass through the bars and the glass kind of breaks and shatters. And she's thinking, what do I do? How do I give them water without opening up the door? Because I open up the door, like who knows what's going to happen. But one of the men says, hey, just kind of pour the water through the bars. And they just kind of baby birded for a while, took turns basically having water poured into their mouths. And they felt better. They moved on. She was okay. Well, the next day she said, we've got to kind of get over to safer accommodations. So she takes at least one of the boys. The other one, I think she kind of left with the house to kind of watch over it for a little while. And she's going to move across the street. Well, the street is littered with dead bodies, which had tried to escape. So as she's running across the road, there's these revolutionaries that are kind of coming. And they seem to fire at her a few times. And she just narrowly escapes into her friend's house. Finally, order is restored both to the town and to Mexico. Mexico got a better president. They felt represented them more fully, and so everything was okay. And life kind of continued on for a little while as normal, but then Melinda's health just kind of continued to fail. And I haven't really talked much about it, but and she really doesn't either, actually. But it turns out that it seems like the very first illness that she got when she arrived in Texas had basically taken its toll on her, and then it kind of become compounded with stress, with other illnesses. And so she had wanted previously to labor and die on the field. She said, it had been the long cherished desire of my heart that I might make my last resting place with the Mexican people and with them rise in the morning of the resurrection as a testimony that she had desired their salvation. But she had kind of changed her mind on this, and not because she didn't want to be buried in Mexico, but because she thought the health of the mission was more important than her personal needs. And so she thought it would be better if the mission just kind of passed into healthier hands. And also it had grown so much that they actually needed more ordained ministers to actually carry on the work beyond what she could do. And she wrestled with this desire to stay, what God wanted, what was best with the mission. But she did decide it is best if I just give it up. She said, I felt thankful that God had given me health and strength to labor for Mexico when no others would condescend to notice such a hopeless field. I thought of the times I had turned and wept because no one appeared to care for these souls. But now evangelical Christians with one heart and one mind say by their actions, we will take Mexico for Christ. What a happy contrast. Missionaries from all Protestant denominations are hastening to spread the gospel among these long neglected people. She travels back to New York to go to her missions org and to resign. And they try to talk her into staying. They're just like, hey, we don't have anybody else we can send. Do what you can, but like, please stay. And so now she has to pray again and kind of wait for things to develop. And so she goes on raising funds for the mission and then waiting. And then she gets called in again. Turns out her org actually wants to transfer her mission to the American board because her board was basically being forced to relinquish all of their foreign fields as other denominations were withdrawing their support. Not really sure what happened there, but if Melinda's anything to go by, it's not terribly surprising that other people got kind of fed up with them as well. But they ask her to meet with the American board, and she lays out the mission before them, told them of its history, its needs, its operating costs, etc. But then she said, although I had full confidence in the American board, yet when I actually came to surrender my dearly cherished treasure, the fruit of more than a score of years of weeping and bearing precious seed, my heart again shrank and I exclaimed, how can I give it up? And I left the rooms of the board without being able to say, I relinquish the mission into your hands. And I retired to my dwelling, passing the night and meditating upon the duty which I felt lay before me. And about the fourth watch of the night appeared one who in other scenes of trial had come, walking upon the sea of trouble and calmed my anxious heart. By faith, I realized that the sympathy of my divine master and the comforting assurance that the mission was his and that he would take care of all its precious interests. Indeed, I was made conscious that it was even dearer to him than to myself. And the next morning, I returned to the rooms and with the full consent of my heart, gave the mission and all its interests into the hands of the American board. About 2 or 3 years had passed since when this event happened and then when she wrote her book. And they had already in that time assumed full responsibility, relieved her of the need to raise funds, and had sent 4 missionaries with more kind of on the way. And then Melinda semi-retired to Illinois, but then continued traveling around the country, writing her autobiography, meeting with women's societies and missionary gatherings, and no doubt continuing to raise support and awareness for the needs of Mexico. And she passed away in 1888 at the age of 77. And I'll end her story where she does. If there is one nation of people more than any other with whom I shall delight to join in singing the song of redeeming love in the day when that great multitude, which no man can number, stands before the throne of God, I am sure it will be with the Mexican nation. If you enjoyed this episode, please head over to Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen and let us know. And as always, thank you for listening to Martyrs and Missionaries. I'm Elise.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.